morning, everybody. The House State Affairs Committee will please come to order. According to my watch, it's about 8:04, and this is our first State Affairs meeting since the interim. So welcome back, and Happy New Year to everybody here and in the audience. Today we have two measures on the agenda. H.A.R. 23, it's a Good Friday Earthquake Remembrance Day, and H.B. 255 on Unmanned Aircraft System. But before we go any further, I'd like to take recall the roll, please.
Representative Millett, excused. Representative Isaacson?
Here.
Representative Keller?
Here.
Representative Gaddis?
Here.
Representative Christ Tompkins?
Here.
Chair Lynn?
I am here. Well, thank you again. Welcome to the committee. We have two bills. We're going to hear H.R. 23 today. Excuse me, Earthquake Remembrance. And we will probably move that bill or resolution. And HB 255, we'll probably study it some more. So let's begin with HR 23. Who's with us on that bill? I should say resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeff Turner.
Please speak up a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeff Turner, staffer Representative Charisse Millett, who apologizes for not being able to attend today's hearing. On March 27th, Alaska will mark the 50th anniversary of the Good Friday earthquake. The 9.2 magnitude quake tore apart 50,000 square miles of south-central Alaska, leveling entire communities and triggering massive tsunamis that brought even more devastation to coastal areas. The purpose of House Joint Resolution 23 is not to highlight the earthquake itself, but to honor the thousands of Alaskans who put the needs of others before their own needs. First responders, medical personnel, the Army Air and the Alaska Army and Air National Guard, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, government employees at all levels, were joined by everyday Alaskans to conduct search and rescue operations, provide medical care, food, shelter, and the restoration of vital services and infrastructure. It was their selfless determination that saved unknown numbers of lives and rebuilt South Central communities before the return of winter. HJR 23 recognizes how a great disaster brought out the best of all Alaskans by proclaiming March 27, 2014 as Good Friday Earthquake Remembrance Day. Representative Millett respectfully asks for the committee's support for the legislation so it can be included in the events that will be marking the 50th anniversary of the earthquake in Anchorage and other South Central communities. On the phone today for invited testimony is Mr. Chuck Vellante. He's an Alaska Air Guard veteran who not only brought the idea for the resolution to Representative Millett, he served at Culiss Air Base during the earthquake and is one of the people honored under this resolution. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any comments or questions from the committee? If not, that was a memorable occasion. At that time, I was in the Air Force, active duty that time, stationed in California, took the family back to Missouri, my wife's hometown in Dexter, and then moved on to Alaska, and I was supposed to be stationed at Fire Island. Turned out I was stationed at Kotzebue, but en route to Kotzebue, we landed at Elmendorf. I took some Arctic training before going on to the radar site at Kotzebue, and I remember the place was still shaking. It was all the aftershocks, and there was something else. You'd be talking to somebody, all of a sudden everybody would be under the desk. And I had an opportunity to go down on 4th Avenue and look at all the various buildings and so on. It was really almost total devastation. National Guard was out there guarding against looters and so on. So I think this is very, very appropriate. A lot of it could have been even worse, but it's a blessing that it was not, and I think this may be an appropriate resolution to consider. Any other comments from the committee? Representative Gaddis? I've got to find my pad here.
Well, as I think back, I can remember 50 years ago. And
I can remember 81 years ago.
You remember when you were 2 years
ago? I wasn't two. I was 57 and 57. So that would have made me 7 years old. And we lived in the interior at the time, and a lot of our Valdez friends came. And I signed on to this bill because I remember a lot of great Alaskans helping other Alaskans that were in need. Now, as a seven-year-old, I know that my mother told me, you know, we're giving these boots, your shoes, and many of our clothes and toys to people who had lost everything in Valdez. So it's what Alaskans do when we have these kind of emergencies, and I'm honored to support this bill. And just thinking, it just gives me the chills thinking about, as a seven-year-old, I didn't know anything about the earthquakes. I thought that this kind of thing happened all the time. I was the oldest of many kids, and I was allowed to go with my dad, who worked at the power plant, to help return the power to Anchorage at that time and also look at Fourth Avenue. And it was very, very interesting to see what had happened, but more interesting to really relive the fact that Alaskans, they didn't look at politics or anything back then. Everybody stood in line to help everybody else out. And that's what we do during these kind of emergencies. So I'm honored to support this resolution.
That reminds me of the United States Congress after the 9/11 conflict. And the entire United States Congress, both parties stood out front of the Capitol and sang God Bless America, as I recall. Everybody, politics was forgotten. When we all come together as Americans and, of course, as Alaskans. Resident Isaacson, Resident Isaacson?
And Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if we could also hear, before I say any comments, from Mr. Vellante, who's on the phone, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah.
I am.
Okay. Mr. Vellante, are you online?
I am. Thank you, Representative Isaacson, for the introduction. I began this quest due to my love of Alaska's unparalleled beauty, its people, and the Alaskan air show that I was privileged to have served with. Excuse me. I believe the time has come to commemorate the tragic events of 50 years ago. I believe history unwritten is history forgotten. This legislation, when passed, will ensure its rightful place in Alaska state history. On Good Friday, March 27, 1964, at 5:36 p.m., Alaska was ravaged by a 9.2 magnitude earthquake, the largest recorded earthquake in U.S. history. It cast a pall of death and destruction covering thousands of square miles of pristine landscapes and lasting over 4 minutes, where seconds seemed like hours. Within an hour, I arrived at Kulas Air National Guard Base, then proceeded with my flight dispatcher responsibilities, organizing flight crews, coordinating the airlift of supplies, equipment, and personnel, all of which was intended to alleviate the suffering of many citizens. Nothing of this magnitude has had more impact on Alaska or its people. All were forever changed. The towns of Valdez, Seward, Portage, Girdwood, and Chenega Village were destroyed. Anchorage and the Anchorage Borough suffered deadly and severe devastation. The Good Friday earthquake destroyed hundreds of dwellings and businesses and created numerous landslides, one of which cascaded several residential blocks of Turnagain-by-the-Sea onto the mud flats of Turnagain Arm and Cook Inlet. The quake and tsunamis was no respecter of borders or boundaries. It continued a path of death and destruction down the Pacific coast all the way to Crescent City, California. The people who were displaced and suffered great loss number in the thousands. It is time to recognize the quake's horrific impact on the state and the selfless rendering of humanitarian aid by first responders, represented by thousands of Alaskan people coming from all walks of life, including countless military personnel. In the face of danger and uncertain circumstances, their display of selflessness, courage, and compassion proved the difference for many lives, even their own, as one life often affects another. The outcome of their efforts impacted not only their generation, but the generations that would follow, even those yet to be born. Their legacy remains intact. As a former member of the Alaska Air National Guard, I dedicate the efforts I have expended to those mentioned within this resolution, to those who made the ultimate sacrifice, true patriots and heroes, and the families they left behind. Time to pay tribute and give memorial to all the lost souls of this tragic event, to acknowledge the thousands who served, to honor their memory, and to give them their rightful place in Alaska state history. In closing, I thank each of you for this opportunity and the support so many of you have shown, and to say that I'll have my deepest respect and honor. Now, if the committee members have any questions, I'm more than willing to respond.
Representative Isaacson has a question or a comment.
Yes, more of a comment than a question at this time. Mr. Vellante, thank you very much for bringing this forward. Thank you for your service. You truly are an outstanding example of the continued service that the Air National Guard and National Guard provide for the citizens of Alaska and throughout the country. I also want to thank Representative Millett's office for bringing this resolution forward. And being in the interior, I grew up in Seattle area, where you're calling from now. And I remember as a kid the building shaking. I don't know if that was exactly 64 or if that was 67 or whichever. It might have been all of them. We used to have the tremblers, and hopefully we won't have that again. But to honor those who sacrifice their lives and sacrifice their time and service of others through this resolution, it's fitting for all Alaskans. And so thank you very much for spearheading this resolution. And I don't know if you can see, but I am wearing the hat, that commemorates the 50th anniversary of the Alaskan earthquake, 1964 to 2024. It has, on one side, and this was made by Mrs. Vellante, it has the Big Dipper and North Star, and then on the other side, little state of Alaska. So I think she'll probably be taking orders, but just to say thank you again for that and to honor this resolution, and I'm definitely going to be supportive of it.
Fine. Representative Isaacson and the committee, it has been my entire privilege, and I have felt very strongly about this for many years.
Thank you very much.
I believe Representative Hughes.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I just wanted to make the comment that to thank all of those that were here and helping, we're remembering them, but we're really expressing appreciation and our gratefulness. And I was thinking, I'm so glad that we're doing the 50th anniversary, not the 100th, so that those who are now seniors, who were adults at that time, and really pulling together as a community, know that we honor them. And it's a reminder, too, of how important it is for communities to pull together and to think about that. And it's also a great reminder for us to think about emergency preparedness, which is a passion of mine. And I understand the state is going to be conducting exercises in many communities, including here in Juneau. And the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs has been in contact with my office about some things they're thinking about here in this building. And so it is very timely. It turns out nationally, across all 50 states, there are going to be exercises, but they're waiting until October. And in Alaska, we'll be doing it here in March. But I just think it's a good reminder for us to remember the importance of pulling together. And even as we prepare for a future possible emergencies, remembering that we're going to be helping our neighbors and those in our communities. So I just appreciate the sponsor for bringing forward this bill and want to recognize and thank all those folks. Representative Gaddis, even as children helped. I don't want to dismiss those. You don't have to be a senior to have helped. But I'm particularly grateful that we are recognizing the 50th while many of those are still here on Earth and know that we appreciate them. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Keller, Vice Chair Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to say thanks to Representative Millett for bringing the bill forward. Very thoughtful, and she can't be here today, and I'm grateful. It's a great way to start State Affairs Committee for the year. I, too, have very vivid memories of the earthquake. I was a senior in high school. We'd come up the year before from Midwest, and as a high school student and with my parents, And we lived in the Turnagain area, so we had a lot of friends there, and so we felt really connected and pained when it all happened. And I kind of used that as a marker in my life. The 64 earthquake is when I became an Alaskan. You know, but anyway, great.
You didn't cause the earthquake.
No, I didn't cause it. No, I'm thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Any other comments from anybody? If not, I have a Buzz Share, I believe it is, Alaska Seismic Hazard Safety. Are you online, sir, or in the room?
Yes, I'm on the telephone.
Fine. Please give your name and, again, whom you represent, and make your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Buzz Share. I'm the current chairman of the Alaska Seismic Hazard Safety Commission. And briefly, which would be rare for me, the commission wanted to commend Representative Millett and her partners in coming forward with this joint resolution. We as a commission fully support it for all the reasons aforementioned earlier so far this morning. In particular, from our perspective as a advocacy group, a commission, for public policy to mitigate earthquake hazards in this state, this sort of thing is probably, realistically, in our day and age right now, the most appropriate fashion to mitigate, to reduce the hazard of earthquakes to the populace of this state. I think, as a society, we really haven't come to terms with how to address what risks are appropriate and the right way to handle them. That's another topic. So in the meantime, certainly public education, public awareness, public preparedness is certainly the most efficient, appropriate, and direct means to mitigate, again, the earthquake hazard we face. Alaska is the most seismically active state in the nation. It's one of the most seismically active places on the planet. Just last year, over 28,000 earthquakes were instrumented in the state, including over 40 that were of magnitude 5 or larger. Magnitude 5, there's nothing magic about it, but that is generally the size of an earthquake that is considered large enough to create damage and possibly injury to people, subject to how close the earthquake certainly occurred and the development right above it. But again, we face this risk daily, and so all we can do to enhance public awareness and so forth, it's a step in the right direction, and it's incredibly appropriate and timely. If I may, we had some suggestions that I think could enhance this resolution even more, but certainly, again, before I go on, we fully commend and support the resolution as is. First, this is more semantics. The earthquake itself has been given an official name by the USGS, and it is referred to as the 1964 Great Alaska Earthquake. It goes by many names. It is and has been referred to as the Good Friday Earthquake. But just for clarification, it is the formal name adopted is the 1964 Great Alaska Earthquake. In line 4, there's a comment about the area that was affected, and as it was earlier mentioned by several others and members of the committee, this earthquake was, it's hard to really capture how large and significant that event was. Ground shaking was felt almost as far away as Barrow. It was felt almost, we were over 700 to 800 miles away from the epicenter in Prince William Sound. It was just such a massive event. In that regard, in line 6, it talks about the largest earthquake in the history of North America. Well, to be more accurate, it's the largest instrumented earthquake in North America. Although, if you wanted to add to that, it was the second largest instrumented earthquake in the world, ever. And, as I think it's been pointed out, too, it was one of two or three probably hallmark or defining moments in the history of this state. Certainly, the purchase or the creating the state is one of them. After that, there was a pause, and then there was the 1964 Great Alaska Earthquake. This brought the state to the attention of the world, but more importantly, it brought earthquakes to the attention of the world. It went a long way to proving theories of plate tectonics. It went an incredibly long way to solving some problems with geologic theories, with engineering theories. It brought to the forefront the ground failure potential that we needed to recognize that had not been recognized in building codes and development and land use planning. It was just monumental in all sorts of directions. And finally, this is certainly probably asking for too much, but if you don't ask, you'll never get. How about considering making March 27th Good Friday Earthquake Remembrance Day forever, not just in 2014? Again, this was a landmark, hallmark event in this state with worldwide ramifications, and the event and the people that devastated and affected and those that participated in it should be remembered forever. Thank you for the opportunity to let me speak this morning, and I would be happy to answer any questions if there are any.
I want to thank you for your testimony, sir. Any questions? Representative Isaacson?
So thank you very much for your testimony, Buzz, and what we'll do is probably request an at-ease to talk with the sponsor to see if they're okay with some of these suggestions. That sounds good. Let me review to make sure I understand. You're suggesting that there would be essentially three amendments. One would be on line three. It would be the magnitude earthquake known officially, the magnitude earthquake officially designated by USGS as the 1964 Great Alaska Earthquake, and known as the Good Friday Earthquake, and then that would Good Friday Earthquake would carry on through. Then line five we would add was the largest instrumented earthquake. Line six, North America, and the second largest instrumented earthquake in the world. And then the last one on line 25, page two, you're asking us to remember this not just on the proclaims March 27th, 2014 as Good Friday Earthquake Remembrance Day, and then add on that and whatever the appropriate language is to remember it on an annual basis thereafter. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Testifier? We're taking at ease. Back on the record, we had a short conversation with Jeff Turner from Representative Millett's office. Any other comments? Representative Keller, Vice Chair Keller.
First, I want to say to Buzz, thank you. I mean, you obviously are really focused on this and appreciate it. I would like to move that we conceptually amend the resolution to be a proclamation that March 27th is the Good Friday Earthquake Remembrance Day from now on.
Okay. Is there any objection? Okay. Without objection, amendment number one passes. Any other amendments? If not, I'd like any other comments. Is anybody else online who would like to testify? Anybody in the audience who would like to testify? If not, we're going to close public testimony and bring this to the committee for potential action. Anyone care to move the bill?
Mr. Representative, I'm ready to go unless there's comments. Okay, I'd like to move HGR 23 from committee. I'll see if I can get this straight after all these years. with individual recommendations, and there is a zero fiscal note that be attached as version C as amended.
Okay. Without objection, H.E.R. 23 passes from committee with our thanks to our testifiers, and, Jeff Turner, and, of course, to Representative Millett. We're taking at ease while we get ready for the next bill. Again at 8:35, we will next be considering HB 255 Unmanned Aircraft Systems, sponsored by Representative Shelley Hughes, who's taking the hot seat down there. And would you please introduce the bill to us and give us a general guideline, and then we'll get into the details.
Thank you, Chair Lynn, and thank you, members of the committee, for hearing our bill today. We're pleased right out of the gate to have a hearing, so we really appreciate that. HB 255 Unmanned Aircraft Systems is a result of a lot of work over the interim. We passed a resolution to establish a legislative task force on this topic, as it is an up-and-coming technology that we are going to see in a wide variety of uses. And my number one concern was privacy. And I also, considering the Fourth Amendment and the use by government agencies with anything, we always want to think that through. So on the one hand, we want to harness unmanned aircraft for beneficial uses for our state, for search and rescue, for monitoring pipelines, for fire, watching for in the event of vast fires in remote places. And in our state, with the lack of roads and infrastructure, it makes sense in for 2 points, that we can save lives with unmanned aircraft, and they're also very cost effective. At the same time, we know what has happened across our country. We've been seeing a lot in the last year regarding privacy, regarding things the federal government has been collecting data and things, keeping phone records and those kind of things. So we are very sensitive to that. So as the task force met over the course of the year, privacy was our number one concern, and we spent most of our time looking at that. This bill is the end product of that, along with another piece that's referred to in your report, which we won't be talking about today, but it is somewhat of a complete package. It's just technically, legally, we had to do them under two pieces. And so today we're talking about the piece that sets the parameters for law enforcement use. And it also has a little piece in there, which is the easiest to talk about, and that is it allows a university to establish a training program for unmanned aircraft system operations for the crew and the mechanics, all the things involved with operations. So as far as the law enforcement use, and I will mention that we have a number of people online too if questions arise, but first I'll just briefly, as far as law enforcement use, it allows unmanned aircraft to gather evidence for a criminal investigation under the express terms of a search warrant, as under Alaska Statute 12.35, and or in accordance with a judicial recognized exception to the warrant requirement. And there also, it addresses the image, the retention of images, and sets the parameters for that, limiting it to for if they're going to be part of an investigation or prosecution or for training. And they're, of course, subject to all federal and state laws and the state's retention policy. And then specifically, we laid out there's in the section, the new section about the law enforcement guidelines following FAA training certification requirements that the chief administrative officer of the law enforcement agency has to approve each use of an unmanned aircraft, and that thorough records be kept, that there be auditable flight records, that the public notification take place unless it would endanger the life of an individual, and that community involvement be involved in policy development, and also that guidelines that specifically address privacy, that the many police departments and troopers around the country are adopting in that section also. And so just to mention, too, we did try to take the balanced approach that a new technology is it's sometimes difficult to predict the future as far as when drafting new laws, because the ever-advancing technology is may go beyond some of the normal application of current laws. And so we will continue to look at it, but we feel like this is a very good start as far as the parameters. And we look forward to your questions. I want to tell you we have online Dean Dawson, who is a state archivist. Oh, he's here in the room, and he, if you have any questions about data retention, he can answer those. We have Lieutenant Rodney Dial online from Ketchikan from the Department of Public Safety. We have Greg Walker online from the University of Alaska that is doing all the research that we've been hearing about the unmanned aircraft test site. And we have Doug Gardner, who's also listening in, if you have any questions for him. And lastly, Annie Carbonetti with the Department of Law. So, Mr. Chair, if it's all right with you, I want to check with my staff to see if she has anything additional that as part of the introduction of the bill. Is that okay with you?
Yes.
Is there anything that...
No, I think this is a great start.
Okay. We're good. Open to your questions and look forward to the discussion.
Thank you very much for bringing this bill forward. I did have a couple of questions, probably a misunderstanding, but like you and most everybody else here, we are concerned about privacy. But I'm trying to wrap my arms around this. It is a new technology. And right now, on the ceiling up here is a camera taking a picture of all of us, not counting the gavel-to-gavel camera, but there's up here, there's cameras in the hallway. You walk downtown, there are all kinds of surveillance cameras in businesses and banks. I assume on a sidewalk someplace here in Juneau, I know it is in most other cities in Alaska and I guess around the world. And what is different about surveillance camera on the sidewalk taking a picture of you as you walk down the street and do whatever you do walking down the street, and that same camera mounted on board an unmanned aircraft flying overhead? Why are we concerned about one and not the other?
Thank you for the opportunity to answer that question, and I will just bring up, along with the balanced approach to about ever-changing technology, the other thing we reminded ourselves as the task force, who really this legislation represents their recommendations, is that an unmanned aircraft is a tool. In itself, it is not evil or good. And so it very much has to do with the operator. It all has to do with the operator and their intentions. And there, as far as the difference, you can put the same kind of camera on a manned aircraft as you could on an unmanned. However, an unmanned aircraft can be smaller, it can be quiet, it can get in places that a large unmanned aircraft can't. And so there is a concern. It can the battery life, the technology is advancing that so that it can be up for extended amounts of time. And interestingly, we're talking much about the Fourth Amendment here as far as the state use, and these are going to be available for commercial use, and there's going to be First Amendment issues with that as far as gathering information and things for regarding First Amendment. So that's something we're not there yet. That will be happening in a year or two. But right now, public use is permitted, so it's important that we address this now. But I would say the fact that they're smaller and quieter, it doesn't necessarily. I will tell you that I was talking to someone about that, and I said, well, you know, with the way technology advances, there will be, if you're wondering if one is hovering outside your window, there will be an app for that. And someone came up to me afterwards and told me there actually is an app for $4.99, which you can point any direction and it'll tell you aircraft, satellites, anything that are in the path. So I do believe that there will be things with technology that will address those things. And I'll also say that knowing what we've heard about drones at the national level, we've heard much about the military use, and the image that is often used by the media is one of a military drone. But much of what we're looking at will be smaller. And right now the FAA doesn't allow anything to be dropped or any kind of weaponizing of an unmanned aircraft. And so there are some safety features right now that I think will bring peace of mind to folks.
Would this affect me if I go downtown and buy a radio-controlled model airplane and put my video camera in it? Would this apply to me or any of us if we did that and fly around wherever I want to fly it?
This particular piece of legislation will not impact that. This just pertains to the university training and to law enforcement use. Just to clarify, a model or hobby unmanned aircraft could be the same piece of equipment that would be a unmanned aircraft for public use or an eventually commercial use. So it will have to do with the purpose of the use as to whether it is considered a hobby model aircraft or an unmanned aircraft for other uses. And so those that are used for a hobby, they fall under other guidelines, and through the I need my staff to, it's the Model Aeronautics Association, Academy of Model Aeronautics, that sets the guidelines and is recognized by the FAA in doing that.
I see. I know these radio-controlled airplanes, or drones they're now called, they come in all different sizes. They can be this big, or they can be gigantic. And all kinds of airplanes, of course, can be controlled from the ground. Even when I used to fly, it actually could have been controlled from the ground. Okay, Representative Keller, let me get my list going here. Representative Keller.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have two questions, I'll do however you want. I'll do the first one, and then if you want me to go to the second one, I can do them both at the same time, whatever you like. The first one is down on page 2, lines 24 through 26. It speaks of the International Association of Chiefs of Police. I have talked to the sponsor here just before the meeting, and I am contemplating an amendment on that section, but I would welcome your comments tell us a little bit about what the International Associations of Chiefs of Police is, and just describe it. But before you do, I'd like to say thank you for bringing this forward. Your concerns on privacy on this issue, it's delving into an area that is brand new, obviously. There's going to be a lot of, probably give and take and discussion, and that takes, you'll feel like you've taken a beating, and thank you for being willing to do that. But
I was just going to say, would you briefly express your concern on international, using the word international in here so she can. I know she knows what we're talking about, but some of the audience may not.
The concern that I brought forward is if you go back up to subparagraph 8, it talks about getting community input and taking that input from the community and then considering that in the process of the driver here. It says the procedures adopted under this section up in line 1 must require at a minimum, by a law enforcement agency's employing these, and then down to 8 where I was, consideration of what the public has to say. And then it goes from that and it says we will adopt the recommendations by an international organization. And it seems to me like it'd be more equitable there. I'm sure they have expertise that I can't even begin to get there, to understand what they know. And I know they have recommendations laid out that you have examined, and you'll be telling us about that. But I still am wondering if the law enforcement agency shouldn't be required to take that into consideration at the same level as community input, as opposed to an international interest. For one thing that crossed my mind as I read this is Alaska is very unique in that we have the privacy clause in the Constitution, not in the U.S. Constitution, and there's a directive in there that legislators are supposed to set guidelines for protecting the right to privacy. That's a tall order. I personally think that we have not done enough. So again, thank you, but I really hesitate at just adopting an international standard without spelling it out, and making it our own, and I also am struggling with the whole idea of considering the international experts at the same level as the community. So thanks.
Thank you. I share those concerns. We make our own laws here, we don't follow international law. Response?
Yeah, thank you for the input, and I have the same aversion to anything international, but it was when I read the document that I realized, and we talked about as a task force, that the guidelines would help protect Alaskans, and we certainly can embed the particular guidelines in the bill to really clarify it and firm it up. Our concern was right now and Lieutenant Dial can speak to this, but the Department of Public Safety has adopted these guidelines. And in the future, we may see local governments deciding to employ unmanned aircraft, and our concern was that they have would offer the same privacy protections. But I'm happy to look at that. I have that same aversion, and I understand where you're coming from. And I do want to say that the guidelines themselves, talk about the importance of community engagement, and if you look at the guidelines, the community engagement and being involved in the policy, of the internal policy make for the agency is part of the process. So it doesn't limit that. It incorporates it, if that makes sense. And could we have Lieutenant Dial maybe speak to the guidelines? Would that be helpful?
Sure. Well, I don't question. I've not read the guidelines. They're probably good guidelines that would be consulted by people but not cemented into Alaska statute. I have no looking at anybody's guidelines on any subject, but I don't know that we should put it into statute that we must look at these guidelines or some version of that. Did you have a...
Yeah.
Representative Isaacson.
You have several people testify, if we could highlight a couple more issues that perhaps they could clarify. And I want to say thank you also, Representative Hughes, for the task force, and just let the committee know that I participated once or twice, but I listened on every single time you guys were there. And so I appreciate the caliber of the individuals serving on the task force. The fact that it was volunteer and that they're contemplating continuing doing that is very important to the state. And I know there's a lot of concerns in parts of my community, and there's a lot of favorable and yet a lot of cynical approaches. We know that Fort Wainwright might be where they station gray eagles. We know the university now is being...
What is a gray eagle?
Gray eagle is one of those big military drones that she was talking about that would fly possibly out of Eielson or out of Fort Wainwright and would be hoping to get... military has expressed a big concern about finding a location that they can immediately access restricted airspace and not go over private residences to allay the fear of government snooping. So I know from our military sources that they're very concerned about the issue that you're bringing forward today. Because I have folks, especially in the Salt area, who are on the southern side of, or the eastern side of Eielson, in the line of sight towards the restricted area, that raise concerns about what about if we're in the training run. And so two things I have here are the public purpose, if we can define that, and I'll amplify with your permission, Mr. Chair, and then the idea of training purposes. And then the third aspect is the municipal ordinance. Having been in municipal government and having been a mayor, I can see the value of using these for downed lines or, you know, putting on an infrared maybe to quickly assess where there might be damage in a utility system, any number of things, parking. I'm just, so I'd like to amplify, what is the public purpose? Is it parking, traffic control, animal control, you know, speed traps, NSA, you know, search for old girlfriends, you know, what is it that the public purpose is? And then on the training aspect, have you defined more of this idea of what is the training purpose for the retention of images? And if it is, if it isn't for a identified public purpose, but they've retained an image of a private citizen, what is the thought right now in the retention of those specific type of images? I know retired Brigadier General Roe Bailey, who is on your committee, showed us at Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation meetings when I was a mayor, wonderful views of how they're using it up north to count the mammals, marine mammals, and a drone can get there where an airplane can't or a helicopter can't. It's quiet. The animals don't slide under the ice, and so we can actually get a count and find out if our mammals are endangered or if they're thriving. A lot of great things, but the people I know in this discussion do have concerns on both sides. How do we deal with the private citizen aspect?
Thank you, Representative Isaacson, through the chair. I don't think the girlfriend would fall under public purpose, but I would say that if a manned aircraft would be permitted, and anything that you could think of that might be used, whether it's going out to look at a forest fire, anything like that, it would apply. That would be my best answer to that. As far as capturing images that might have a private citizen in them, if there's case law has shown that is if there is a reasonable expectation of privacy in that situation, then the images could not be retained and not be used and not be admissible. And but I would, as far as the retention of images, I'd like to defer to our state expert on that, Dean Dawson, if he wanted to address that through the chair.
I know it's I can't imagine flying anywhere, either in a manned aircraft or with a drone, without going over somebody's private residence someplace. You know, they're everywhere, maybe not in large groups, but out in the bush. You know, if somebody's got their cabin out in the middle of no place, and you fly over inadvertently and take the photograph. On the retention of images, I know that, you know, your cameras downtown on the streets and so on, they retain images for a period of time. Matter of fact, we caught those crazy Boston Marathon bombers because the images that were in fact retained. So again, I guess those images could have been taken by an unmanned aircraft as well as on the sidewalk there.
Well, and just as a follow-up,
Isaacson,
that's the other side of this, is the definitely the public benefit, because we have Google Earth, for example, which we all rely upon as a base map, and it captures all sorts of stuff.
You can actually drive down the street with the Google and look at, you know, I've looked at places I used to live. It's very interesting.
Right. So the public purpose, as I was trying to explain, on both sides, how are we going to balance this? I guess this goes back to the chair's question or deputy vice chair's question, whoever, about what is the impact if we set a guideline for this that is different than for something else, whether satellite or the store, shopkeeper, you know, I mean, are there unintended consequences of this in trying to protect our people from abusing the system to having a beneficial purpose. I guess that's where we're trying to get down to. Because that forest fire was also another thing. U.S. Army Commander General Shields was saying if he could have used drones, we could have gotten the fire out in Fairbanks much quicker this last year.
Where to go first,
Thank you. As a task force, we were very careful to try to not single out this tool and punish it, you know, as a tool. And I think it's a little hard not to mention this, although it doesn't pertain particularly to law enforcement, but there's economic opportunity for our state in this matter. If we single out and are extremely restrictive with a tool, we might miss an opportunity. And because we can harness them for beneficial uses, that is something I would say could be an impact if we were to single them out to a degree beyond other. Although, you know, there are, as we talked about earlier, the fact that they're small and quiet, there are certain things that we do need to address that will make it a little bit different than a manned aircraft. And that's why, with law enforcement use, this bill has come forward.
Thank you, Representative Keller.
Thanks. Another question, if I could. But on that topic, it helps me. Section 2 is directed at law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
So the fire thing, that'd be outside of that parameter. I guess maybe that's covered in Section 4 because that's a different section of law, and I haven't even checked to see what Section 29 there is referring to. I have another question, but first, I just was handed this by my staff yesterday, if you can believe it. A guy by the name of Rodney Brossart, a farmer in North Dakota, got the award for being the first U.S. citizen to be thrown in jail using unmanned aircraft. This is yesterday. Unmanned. No, this is unmanned. It was a deal where a farmer's cows wandered across into his property, and he refused to give them back, and it degraded into a armed standoff, and I guess the unmanned aircraft was there to gather data, and he was convicted based on that. And so anyway, it's real. It's a real issue, one we have to deal with. But I haven't got to my question. If you want to respond, go ahead.
Yeah, I would actually like to respond because that was brought to my attention, and I reviewed it with Lieutenant Steve Adams with the Department of Public Safety, and he said, could that have happened? It could not. A search warrant would have been required in our state. So those circumstances would not have played out the same because we have, as you said before, the legislature's been tasked with, through the clause in our Constitution, to set out the laws regarding privacy, and we have very strong laws. So that would not have happened here in Alaska.
The interesting response, I'm sorry about the dialogue, but I can't, we both have the danger when you take one news article, to take it and go too far with it. But it's interesting that was his defense, that there was no warrant for the drone surveillance, but it was a federal judge that denied that defense. Okay, that just brings alarm bells to me. I just don't get, there's a lot there that I don't know, and mm-hmm. I could be suggesting something that doesn't exist. Back to my question. Page 3. again, this is on the retention of images there. Down on line 10 in particular, and Representative Isaacson has referred, I think, to that section already. But I would just like some examples of state laws that may be made that would be an exemption, that would exempt. The statement here is that the images cannot be retained unless, and then one is unless there's a state law. And what kind of an exception? And you don't have to answer this right now, but I would just want to get a picture, and I haven't been able to. I think Representative Isaacson suggested several possibilities that might happen at the municipality level. But I was just wondering, as I was contemplating your bill, I was thinking, what kind of a state law would be passed that would say, okay, it's okay to keep those images in the context of law enforcement? If other states have gone there, or what we're trying to protect here.
Well, I may be missing, but in what we're laying out here is that for investigation or prosecution purposes or training purposes specifically, and then we have retention policies that these images would fall under, other things right now. And actually, the task force did hear from Department of Public Safety that the retention, current state retention policies do provide some challenges for them, and it's something that we decided not to address because it impacts more than just this, and it's something that we have recommended the state look at the retention policies overall. So we could certainly, I think it might be helpful to hear from Dean Dawson, Chair, if that is all right, so he could explain. He could explain now the state law that might cover these and how long the they would be held. And
name, please.
Dean Dawson.
Okay.
If I could, quick.
Okay, Representative Keller.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And he probably does have, a response to that. But, that's why I was raising the question, is that, as law enforcement looks at this in the future and they want guidelines as whether or not a particular, data can be retained or not, if it's confusing in the statutes now, the question in my mind is, do we need to address that, and is a blanket wide open door for any state law that comes along that says they can retain, is that what we want to do? It's a question that I'm sure we'll get responded to.
Yes, and through the chair, I would ask, in addition to Dean Dawson commenting on this, that it would be good to have Lieutenant Rodney Dial, because they're dealing with images through other cameras, security cameras and things like that, in addition. So they already have policy, and I believe this would fall under the same. So could we have Mr. Dawson?
I'm going to ask you, we have several people who want to testify, who would be best. So is it Steve Johnson? Are you in the audience or on the phone?
Is who? I don't know.
Mr. Johnson, are you available? So much for Mr. Johnson. Yes.
Mr. Chair, would it be possible to have Mr. Dawson and Mr. Dial speak to this image?
Yes, but I don't know where Mr. Johnson is.
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, Dawson.
Yeah,
Dawson.
Dawson.
Okay, I'm sorry. Where?
Dean Dawson.
He's standing back here waving at me. Come on down. And Lieutenant Dial, are you here or on the phone?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am online.
Okay. Please, both of you, identify yourselves, and then Mr. Dawson might like to go first.
Yeah, I'm Dean Dawson. I'm the State Archivist with the Division of Libraries, Archives, and Museums. Thank you.
And Lieutenant Dial, please identify yourself.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm Lieutenant Rodney Dial with the State Troopers based in Ketchikan, Alaska.
Fine. Thank you both. Mr. Dawson.
Yeah, through the chair, the state records retention policies under AS 4021 apply to the retention of images, and retention of images is also captured under the state's general administrative records retention schedule, which prescribes mandatory retention periods for all state records. There is a 30-day retention for video footage, for example, and then, of course, the caveat is unless there is a pending litigation, audit, investigation, or law enforcement activity. So we would recommend that the Department of Public Safety implement that records retention review and stipulate on their valid retention schedule that the Attorney General signs off on also exactly how long those images would be retained. Now, regarding the dissimilarity of retention periods, say a local government body requires a longer retention, or the state or federal government has differing retentions, the general premise in the records and information management field is to retain for the longest period of time. Those images would be confidential and privileged pending a Freedom of Information Act request, which we would recommend that DPS go ahead and prescribe procedures through policy development exactly what the course of action for release of any potential privacy documents would be.
Now, these would be obviously for governmentally acquired images, correct?
Yes, sir.
would this in any way impact private accumulation of images? For example, the images being taken on gavel to gavel right now, all of your TV stations retain images, I guess, for varying periods of time, going back into historical things. Would this in any way impact anything we do here, impact that?
Honorable Chair, no. The State Records Retention Act only applies to state government entities, and we provide guidance to local governments upon request, but they're not bound by our statute.
Okay. Representative Gaddis?
What is our what are our laws now in regards to manned aircraft if we take those same pictures with a manned aircraft? I'm wondering what the difference is.
I'm, through the chair, Honorable Gaddis, I'm not aware of any distinguishing parameter manned v. unmanned.
Representative Isaacson.
Mr. Dawson, it was a curious statement you just made. Local governments are not bound to the state administrative code on retention?
Through the chair, Honorable Isaacson. No, under our statute, we just advise local governments and local political subdivisions upon request. And how we do that is provide consulting, and we also develop and have a current general retention schedule for local governments. 95% of the local governments out there follow what we prescribe and want to because they look to us for guidance.
All right, thank you.
Representative Hughes.
Yeah, I was just going to say that the record retention policy is for records acquired by state departments within our state. So it's not, you know, governing all the people of Alaska. So just to clarify.
Well, just a follow-up. All right, so in my mind, I was just rehearsing things that my clerks have said in the past and Alaska Municipal League issues and so forth. So it was curious. So thank you for the little bit of information. So you're saying primarily you set up guidelines that municipalities defer to because you've already thought through all the issues that archivists need to think through.
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson. Yes, in fact, we solicit the clerk's input for our retention schedules also.
Okay. And follow up? Do you also engage the public then in the development of your retention schedules?
Through the chair, generally speaking, no.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else at this point? We can come back to you any time. Lieutenant Rodney Dial, would you care to make any comments?
Mr. Chairman, we have no concerns with the image retention requirements in this legislation and believe that they strike the right balance between the privacy concerns and operational effectiveness that the department would need. So we're supportive of the image retention requirements.
Okay, any questions for Lieutenant Dial? Okay. Thank you. Please hang around. We probably have some more questions as we proceed. I have several names here. I'm just going to go down the list. Gregory Walker, are you available in the room or online?
Yes, I am.
Please identify yourself and make whatever comments you'd like.
Sure. I'm Gregory Walker. I'm the Chief Technology Officer and founder of the Alaska Center for Unmanned Aircraft Systems Integration at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Excuse me. Can you turn up the volume a little bit? Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Okay.
Go ahead.
No problem. I am, if you've been looking at the University of Alaska's program of unmanned aircraft over the last decade, I was the start of that and still leading it from a technical perspective today. Doing the operations for wildlife and for oil and gas and for climate change and emergency response, etc. One thing I'd like to say is we're really looking at this record retention issue, and this is from the technical body, having worked in this technical area for 30 years now. There is really no new technology here. It's just the thing that is new with these unmanned aircraft is how the technology for surveillance is being employed. You know, there are dashboard cameras in public vehicles today that record imagery and exactly what those images capture and how they could be used in law is an ongoing concern or ongoing issues. I appreciate that with regard to records retention and do you require search warrants, etc. The task force that we got to be a part of here actually is very progressive in the sense that across the nation, many, if not every state, is dealing with this concern. And we have been trying to design a process to go forward that protects our constitutional rights for privacy, at the same time put a clear statement out to the public across the world, that Alaska is open for business with regard to this technology, and please have us use the resources we have in Alaska, our climate change, diversity, our large land masses, and our technical need up here for the capability of this technology to help us mature that, which is good for our own economic benefit in the state. There really isn't. We've asked these questions many times with legal counsel across the country from other states and from the technical community. What is new with regard to unmanned aircraft that would warrant to be segregated out of general technology, technical areas? And quite honestly, we did not identify anything in that area. There is a separate issue with regard to privacy, individual privacy, paparazzi kind of concerns with unmanned aircraft. And this task force that identified that as a concern in the area wanted to make sure we had a clear position on the public use of the aircraft and how the public agencies, for example, the University of Alaska or Department of Natural Resources or Alaska Public Safety, can manage the technology. Did that answer your question, sir?
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? If not, please hang around. We may have some more here.
I will.
Thank you. Mayor Luke Hopkins? Are you there?
Yes, thank you very much.
Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I am Mayor Luke Hopkins, Fairbanks North Star Borough. And I want to, of course, thank Chairman Lynn for this opportunity to testify and for the committee members to be present and ask questions as they may. But a special thanks to the sponsors to bring this legislation forward. The first piece in Section 1 is very important to the Fairbanks North Star Borough, but also to the state, where upon this bill being signed into law, will establish in statute that the University of Alaska actually may develop a training program for unmanned aerial systems. And that whole discussion, I'd be glad to enter into that with anybody, because it's very important for the state's economic development. As you know, I think everybody's aware that UA has been designated to be the lead in the FAA test site for developing the ability for unmanned aerial vehicles to some future time to be in commercial airspace. But the other piece that's important, and I don't want to diminish that, for the university to advance research, development, and the use of technology to benefit both our residents and the citizens in this country with the safe use of unmanned aerial systems. But for sure, there's a very important piece that we all know, that our citizens demand that we uphold the privacy and transparency of law enforcement, and that's why the major piece of this legislation is so important for our citizens, with the proposed amendments that should provide proper oversight within the judicial parameters of our law enforcement agencies. And I know that here in our borough, we have three overlying law enforcement agencies, and I've spoken to the chief of police here in the city of Fairbanks, and we all understand the importance of this issue of gathering information that a police agency, a law enforcement agency, certainly works to gather. But we understand that the procedures that you're discussing in this bill set forth I think, a fair and reasonable activity concerning law enforcement oversight. What we certainly don't want to do, though, is lose the aspect of the private use, or I want to say commercial use, the economic development of unmanned aerial systems. And I think that, that the task force that has been referred to many times in this hearing has done incredible work on establishing those. And I also understand in this legislation, in Section 4, where it speaks to amending Title 29, and 29 is Section 29, or Title 29 to me as mayor, I understand it, that a municipality may not adopt an ordinance that permits the release of images captured by unmanned systems in the manner inconsistent with that law enforcement aspect that it refers to. We get this. I get this. I'm sure that any future assemblies will get this. It'll be law. So I just want to conclude with saying that there are many, many benefits that the application of unmanned aerial systems can have for our state. You've heard some, you'll hear many more. And I think that's the piece to keep in mind, that while we have to regulate, we also don't want to regulate out of existence this new technology. I thank you for this opportunity to testify on this legislation.
Thank you very much, Mayor. Any questions from the committee? Representative Isaacson.
Just a comment. Thank you, Mayor Hopkins, for tracking this and being an advocate and a strong voice in our community for the unmanned system at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. One of the questions I would have as a municipal CEO, this allows law enforcement applications. And the borough doesn't have, the Fairbanks North Star Borough is second class and has not been given these type of powers, law enforcement powers, and you mentioned the other police chiefs that you talked with. But you do have concerns of public safety in the outlying areas, and we have our ABADE program and such, and I know the borough tracks it, and since you're the mayor online right now, how do you see this working to help us with issues, especially regarding the drug trade and so forth, in the outlying areas, especially of the borough, that are hard to get to? Do you have any particular concerns, or do you feel that this is being adequately addressed through reference to these other statutes?
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, the work that our borough has in relationship with Department of Public Safety, the detachment here in the interior, whether you're talking about their use of fixed-wing or rotary-wing aircraft, those actions are already occurring. So like we've heard, introducing the proper and regulated and lawful use of unmanned aerial vehicles, whether you put the camera on the bottom of the helicopter or you put it on an unmanned aerial system, I think that the sections of this law that are certainly tying back into what we are allowed to do, what law enforcement is allowed to do, and more specifically what law enforcement is not allowed to do, are pretty clearly laid out in this legislation. And as we heard from the from Representative Hughes, this is a starting point. This is as much as we think we know, and again, we can amend this as we move along if something else comes up. Let's say we have, I certainly don't know anything about low-flying satellites, but all these things can be put together at a later time. So I think it's adequate.
I appreciate your clarification. Thank you.
Thank you. Reverend Keller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not the money but waters, but I'm just having a hard time getting my brain about we're in Article 20 or we're in Section 29 here about a home rule general powers, and it makes a reference back to a section of the law that is dealing with law enforcement, and I'm just trying to understand it. If we have a new law show up in Article or in Section 29, and it just has this prohibition, that they may not release images.
Inconsistent
with just that one section of law that we're introducing. If there's any implication here of anything to do with technology data, you know, collected that's outside of that narrow 0.903. You know, I just to put on the record that I'm working on it. And I'm working that with a sponsor.
Representative Hughes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keller, I'm wondering whether Annie Carpinetti might be able to answer some of these questions.
Yes, I plan to call her next.
Okay, I think perhaps if she might be able to address that, it would be helpful clarification.
Thank you. I wanted her to hear all the testimony before she came up and made her comments. So I'd like to invite Annie Carpinetti to come forward. She's worked with me and other people for a long period of time, and she's always been a voice of reason in all kinds of bills. I want to thank you for the good advice you've given in the past. I assume you give some good advice here.
Well, thank you. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I signed up today to answer questions.
And I just moved the mic closer.
I signed up today to answer questions, and I'll be happy to try and do so. One of the questions from Mr. Chairman was from Representative Keller about statutes dealing with records retention. And there are state statutes that do limit or put constraints on law enforcement, not only state law enforcement, but municipal agencies on retention of evidence. Yes. And in 2010, the legislature passed a retention of evidence law that requires in homicide investigations that the evidence be retained for up to 50 years or the length of the time that the case was unsolved, whichever is longer. I think it's whichever is longer. And in, for example, in sexual assault cases, some evidence, the DNA evidence, has to be kept for as long as the defendant is required to register as a sex offender. And if that's a sexual assault or sexual abuse in the first degree, that's for the duration of his or her life. So there are statutes, and they bind municipal and state law enforcement agencies.
Clarification, Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Ms. Carbonetti. Did you say 50 or 15 years?
I said 50. And that's homicide.
50 for a homicide.
Yes, or for the period that the case is unsolved, whichever I think is shorter.
Okay.
I could tell you. I could read it to you if you'd like.
No, that's fine. That's fine. Okay. Just one.
Please continue.
Are there any other questions?
Any questions? My goodness, you answered them all. Thank you very much.
Sure, you're welcome.
I'm going to keep public testimony open, but is there anybody else on the line that would care to...
Mr. Chair.
There is.
For Ms. Carbonetti, before she leaves.
You're not escaping yet.
So thank you again. Going back to these couple themes that we have, the public purpose and training purposes, municipal ordinance, what is currently on the books and how does that play into this bill from legal standpoint?
Well, generally, through the chair, Representative Isaacson, law enforcement keeps records in an investigation for according to statute, depending on the seriousness of the case and whether or not there's an appeal, they usually are required to keep it throughout the period that a case could be appealed or a post-conviction relief action taken. And I could get you more definite rules regarding each particular type of case. It depends on the law enforcement agency, too. I mean, a small village has less ability to retain evidence as Anchorage, for example, and it has a huge new facility for that. And when the legislature was debating this evidence retention requirements, it tried to adopt laws that took into account the size of the law enforcement agency and their ability to preserve evidence. There's always a tension between keeping evidence for prosecution purposes and returning it to the owner of the evidence. And there's a bill that passed last session that set up a procedure for a victim to be represented by the Office of Victims' Rights to bring an action in case that victim believes that the police were retaining property that belonged to them unnecessarily. So there's a tension there between what you keep and what you give back and what you dispose of. And, you know, a sofa with DNA evidence on it, there's a provision in the law that says you can take cuttings from that sofa from the that are most likely to contain evidence of DNA to preserve, and if an agency doesn't have room for that sofa, maybe taking a cutting from the sofa would be the best way to preserve the evidence and then not have to retain the entire sofa.
So a couple follow-ups from that. So in the application, you can't necessarily take a cutting out of some of these images, I suppose, but the application then to the training purposes or municipal ordinance, maybe let me ask specifically, we heard from the archivist that municipalities don't have to follow the state archiving schedules, but in law enforcement, that's different. Don't our law enforcement, municipal law enforcement officials have to follow the criminal laws established by the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, yes, that's correct. The municipal law enforcement agency are bound by the state law in this regard.
Okay. So if we establish it here for law for criminal purposes or law enforcement agency purposes, whatever we do on the state side will govern the municipal side.
Well, you would want to make it clear, but yes, I mean it could. You could say municipal law enforcement agencies, and I assume it probably does. A law enforcement agency, and I'm trying to.
On page 3, for example, line 10. It mm-hmm. says, under retention of images, the law enforcement agency, and then it talks about by federal or state or by municipal ordinance. And I'm right. wondering at what point, this has always been part of my question, at what point does municipal ordinance have more weight than state law in law enforcement?
Oh, through the chair, that's interesting. I'm no expert in Title 29, but I know that there are provisions in Title 9 that say that state law rules, and I would have to look at that Title 29 to get an answer to you. I'm sure there are lawyers around that could answer right off the top of their head, but I'd have to get that back to you.
Right. I'd appreciate it, Mr. Chair, if we did, just because I don't want to get our municipal governments at odds if they do something more lenient than criminal requirements of the state. And I know my police chief back in North Pole would probably not be more lenient in that regard, but to guide municipal governments more clearly in this, I would think if law enforcement is the state purview, then we should probably clarify this line 10 on page 3, the boundaries of the municipal ordinance, because right now to me this was a little confusing. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Thank you. Vice Chair Keller?
Yeah. In my struggling to understand, I just want to know, are there sections of law that govern the retention, release of images that are collected outside of law enforcement at all that you're aware of? I mean, directly, is there sections on that? Like, the example I'm thinking about is, government takes images looking for forest fire problems, you know, and then subsequently law enforcement needs those files. But there is nothing that, I mean, those could be just potluck. I mean, they may or may not be around forever because, as I understand it, we don't regulate the release or retention of images that are outside of law enforcement, or did I misunderstand?
Through the chair, I think what you're asking is, is there state law that regulates retention of images taken by private people?
No, by government.
By government.
Yeah.
Government. Oh, non-law enforcement.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure there are. I mean, Mr. Dawson testified that there are standards for retention of public records.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. I was busy reading and I missed that. I'll go back and review it. Thank you.
Thank you. Is Barbara Johnson available?
Representative Lynn, yes, thank you. This is Barbara Johnson, Special Assistant to Mayor Luke Hopkins of the Fairbanks North Star Borough. And I'll keep my comments brief. I just wanted to thank Representative Hughes and the task force for the work that they've done. And I had the ability to attend several of their meetings. And we really, really appreciate on privacy issues. Concerns were heard along with discussing how other states approached it. And where missteps have been made, they took a really close look so we can learn from that. And the other thing I wanted to note is we have worked really hard on the economic development side of this industry. And just for everyone's background, the Association of Unmanned Vehicle Systems International 2013 study showed that in Alaska, direct jobs have the potential to bring in 19 million with 95 jobs from 2015 to 2017, and it increases from there to 112 million with 141 jobs between 2015 and 2025. I would also like to thank the University of Alaska for their tremendous work and ongoing efforts and their participation in the task force, and then also their work in the community and also around the state. So I'll keep my comments really brief, but just wanted to say thank you, everyone, for all of your hard work on this industry.
Thank you for testifying. Any questions?
Mr. Isaacson. Thank you. And Ms. Johnson, thank you so much for all that you've been working on in this. I just need a clarification. I've been drinking water, not enough coffee, evidently. The 95 million to 125 million, 100 plus jobs, you're talking about just in the state of Alaska with this industry?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to make sure I heard you right. Thank you.
Very good. Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Is there anybody else online who'd like to testify today? Anybody in the audience would like to testify today? I'm going to keep public testimony open because we need to consider this bill again. I think it's very, very interesting. This is kind of cutting edge of the law here because, you know, the unmanned aerial vehicles, great opportunities and some hazards also. Which goes along with great opportunities. What's the saying? No risk, no reward. With that, I'm going to close out this bill and thank everybody who testified. Our next meeting is Thursday, except we're not going to have a meeting on Thursday, but we're going to bring this bill back and examine some more. Everybody, please study this bill very carefully for any amendments that may want to be made or for potential action on the bill at the next meeting. From when it leaves this committee, if it does, it goes to the Judiciary Committee. And, of course, he's heard the testimony here, so that's very good. And anything else from the committee at this point? Representative Hughes.
I just wanted to say, the Chair, because of your photography that you do, I expect someday to see you down on the ground operating an unmanned aircraft with a camera and
I thought you were going
posting
to give,
wonderful photos on Facebook.
I thought you were going to take a picture of me taking unauthorized photos. So thank you very much for the meeting, and good to be back. We are.